Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Shirley Min, in for Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman Arendt. Shirley, as always, it's a pleasure to have you here.
I'm so happy to be here.
What are we talking about today on the show? Should I tell everybody?
Yes.
Okay. We're talking about something that I think for most folks is pretty aggravating and confusing, and we're going to try to demystify it today. I'm talking about customer service. You know, you have a problem with a product, you call the number, or you start typing away to the chatbot, and an hour later, you're like, what the heck just happened?
Yeah, you need to do some deep meditative breaths before any customer service call.
And maybe afterwards, too.
Yeah.
So if you want to participate in that conversation, which will be with a Wall Street Journal reporter who covers all of this, customer service and user experience, give us a call. Our number is 888-477-9499. We want to hear your customer service thoughts and opinions and maybe even your horror stories, if you got them. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And then after that, Shirley, in the third segment, we're going to hear an interview with the great Amy Tan.
Can't wait for that.
I have not heard this interview yet, so I'm very excited to hear it. And Amy Tan, many of you know, is the author of The Joy Luck Club and other great novels. Her latest book is about birds and birding, which is something that she got into later in her life. And so we're going to hear about Amy Tan and her thoughts on birds.
Yeah, I can't wait for this because I love Amy Tan. Also, I love birds. I am also late into birding myself. So many parallels.
In the Venn diagram of your life, this is right in the middle.
100%.
Before we get to all of that, though, let's talk about some news headlines percolating in our region. Shirley, kick us off.
Okay. So former President Trump is headed to South Jersey on Saturday for a campaign rally in Wildwood. Mm. And this is his second time there. Mm. So he held a rally in 2020 at the Wildwood Convention Center. At that time, it was dead of winter, bitter cold, but it was still one of his biggest, most well-attended rallies. Hmm. So this time, the convention center was booked, so it was not available. But this rally this weekend is going to be on the beach, coinciding with Mother's Day weekend. So this is like a popular time to go down the shore.
Yep.
This beach can fit upwards of 40,000 folks. So this is going to be a big event. Now, Cape May County, heavily Republican, despite New Jersey being
Solidly Democratic,
correct, since 1992. Here's another thing, too. The campaign, so Trump's campaign has paid the city in advance $54,000. Now, these are to cover expenses associated with police, EMT.
Yeah, it's a big event.
Big event. And there's some history here, because the last time Trump came to Wildwood, the former mayor, Pete Byron, said that he failed to reimburse the town for some expenses.
So they wanted money up front this time.
Correct. They were like, you're not going to fool me twice.
Yeah.
Which is a familiar theme for Trump because, I guess according to this 2019 report from the Center for Public Integrity, Trump's reelection campaign owed 10 cities a grand total of $841,000. Now,
other rallies and expenses
that were never reimbursed.
Hmm, interesting. So there's a little backstory here.
There is some backstory, and so that's why they were asking for that money up front.
It's interesting, like you said, that he's going to Wildwood. That, like as you mentioned, that part of New Jersey leans right, the state leans left, and it's not really a swing state. However, we should note that Donald Trump's spending a lot of his time in New York these days and probably can't travel too far afield. So that might dictate where these rallies are taking place.
Right.
That's just pure speculation on my part. And I'll also note that, you know, over the years, he has drawn attention to his connection to the Jersey Shore, specifically Atlantic City, where at one time he owned several casinos and was a big name in that town. Casino business didn't go great for him there overall in the long run, but he still talks about it as a success in part of his business empire and his business journey. So there is also some connection there.
Yeah. And you know, politics aside, the mayor of Wildwood, Ernie Traiano, says this really is like an economic shot in the arm for that whole place. You know, all the pizza shops, the hotels, the businesses. I mean, this is a huge economic impact.
Sure.
And so that was a big motivator for him because all eyes are going to be on Wildwood and why not? So, you know, kind of.
So the shops will be busy in Wildwood.
Yes.
Maybe you can't grab a sandwich, but you can grab a sandwich at Middle Child, which is a lovely sandwich shop. The first location is right around the corner from us over on 11th Street. Great sandwiches, Shirley. And then they have a second location in Fishtown. They're going to open one at the Philadelphia Airport. They say they want to expand to other cities in the future. But they got a problem. Because the latest thing that they're serving up, I believe it's served on ciabatta with a big old slice of lawsuit in the middle. Because there's a company, a proposed restaurant out in Las Vegas that wants to use the name Middle Child. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to trademark it. And Middle Child is saying, hey, you're blocking our grand ambitions of expansion by stealing this name that we've had for several years. And so now they're in the middle of it, a big lawsuit, this Philly-based sandwich company, with this proposed potential restaurant out in Las Vegas, setting up a showdown of culinary titans.
Yeah. Now, this already sets off my inner Philly everything.
Like, you're mad.
You defend Philly all costs. Doesn't matter what the reasons are. So already a little heated over this.
You're mad at Las Vegas.
I'm mad at Las Vegas. I'm mad that Vegas is trying to open this restaurant that we already claimed dibs on the name. But dibs is not enough because it seems Middle Child Philly does not have the trademark on the name, which is where all this is going, you know, where all this started, which I wish they had just filed for the trip. Anyway, they're mad. But listen, I like what they said on Instagram.
Yes.
Do you want to read that?
Well, they have a very, they've always had a colorful
yeah.
social media presence, Middle Child. In addition to the great sandwiches, they said on their Instagram, quote, if these dummies out in Vegas think they can ride our coattails of 7 years of hard work, they have another thing coming.
Oh, you got
it. I don't know
right.
if that statement stands up in the court of law, but it certainly stands up in the court of public opinion, especially among Shirley Mays.
Oh, yeah. Look, I'm on their side. I'm already there. There is no convincing me. And here's what else got me kind of all my feathers ruffled.
You are more invested in this story than
I'm so invested.
Assumed.
I know. Yeah. Are we out of time?
No.
But
go
listen,
for it.
An attorney for the Las Vegas mm-hmm. other restaurant, the Poser Middle Child, they were proposing that they're going to allow Philly Middle Child to just continue to use the name at all its city locations while the Vegas group would use the name nationally. Like,
no,
what?
We're not going for that.
No. Who would? So I'm all sorts of heated with this.
And you know what? Philly's kind of a middle child type of city.
Mm-hmm.
100%. You know, sort of in the pecking order of cities. So this is our fight, and I'm with you, Shirley Min. let's go to our next story now, and I think you can set this one up
okay,
for us.
Okay, so this is a tough one, too. You know, Pico has more than 2 million customers,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately, scammers are going after them hard.
Hmm.
So about 900 customers have reported that scams to Pico since the beginning of the year. Now, this obviously doesn't include any scams that went unreported.
Right.
Okay. But
the
most
common. That's still an unusually high number.
It is unusually high. And the most common scenario is the scammer will reach out to you and say your payment didn't go through and that your electricity or gas will be disconnected unless you pay immediately. And why this hits people, I think, and mm-hmm. gets people is because in February this year, Pico's billing system was down for a week.
Yeah, for like an upgrade, I believe.
Right.
Yeah.
And it caused a lot of customer confusion.
Right.
And so that problem with online services made some customers nervous about their payments, which just opens the door wide
right.
open for
scammers yeah.
who are aggressive, but also sophisticated.
Yeah, they're savvy. Yeah.
Really savvy. Now, Pico does say they never ask customers to make payments over the phone. They also do not immediately disconnect service.
You'll never get a call out of the blue, we're shutting it off today.
Correct.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
that should be one red flag. One customer reported to the Inquirer that they were prompted to pay in Bitcoin. Another
yeah, that's a
red,
huge
flag.
Red flag.
Huge red flag.
Yeah.
So this is kind of just all in the midst of everyone getting a lot of unwanted calls, period. And the FCC says that each month, U.S. consumers receive about 4 billion robocalls.
That's crazy.
So,
well, we're going to talk about customer service later. We know the world of phone calls can be a very confusing place. And that sometimes you get contacted from companies, legitimate contact, that is also confusing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I understand why people get taken by these. And like you said, the scammers are sophisticated and they saw this weakness, right?
100%.
With this February billing upgrade that would create enough confusion for them to slip in there. And so you have to be on the lookout for that. One thing I am on the lookout for in a positive way is Mother's Day coming up over the weekend. Happy Mother's Day to you, Shirley Lynn.
Thank
you. And I hope you have a lovely one. I will inform our listening audience that Mother's Day, if you didn't already know, has Philadelphia roots. It kind of started here. Did you know this?
I did not know that.
There's actually a plaque. I can't remember. I think it might be the east side of City Hall mm-hmm. that commemorates this. But yeah, the idea for modern Mother's Day, and there were sort of prior versions in other countries that are not exactly antecedents to our Mother's Day, but had, you know, the idea had already been circulating. But the Mother's Day that we celebrate now began with a campaign by a woman named Anna Jarvis here in Philadelphia, who was honoring her mother, who actually had just passed away. And so she got the idea going in around 1907. And John Wanamaker, the great department store magnate, kind of helped carry the idea nationally.
Love it.
And by 1914, it had been, you know, inscribed by Congress, a pretty rapid ascent from 1907 to 1914.
As it should.
However, I will pour a little cold water on this. Anna Jarvis, the idea that she had was a little more like, not solemn, but like serious and mm-hmm. reflective, kind of have like a service mm-hmm. to honor your mom or the mothers in your life. And she did not enjoy the way it was quickly commercialized and turned into gift giving and,
right.
and cards and all that. She was not a fan. So she actually turned on Mother's Day in her own lifetime. So if your mom says, you know, where's the gift? You could say, well, I'm honoring Anna Jarvis this year by not getting you the gift and just appreciating you, Mom. I'm giving you that out, folks. I'm not saying you should take it. I'm just giving you that out. I'm also saying that this segment is over. We are out of here. We're going to break, and we're going to talk about customer service, slimy customer service people like me when we get back. You're listening to Studio 2. Welcome to the noon hour of WHYY Radio. How can I help you?
Hi, I'm Shirley Minnan for Cherry Gregg. I was hoping you could transfer me to Studio 2, Segment 2.
You asked for Susudio by Phil Collins. If this is correct, please say no.
Wait, what? I asked for Studio 2, Segment 2.
Studio 2, Segment 2. If that is correct, please press 1 and 3 at the same time.
How could I even press them at the same? Can I just talk to a human being with a pulse?
You asked to hear The Pulse.
Oh my gosh.
With Mike and Scott. If that is correct, enter your social security number.
There's no way. Absolutely no way.
Goodbye.
Oh my gosh, where am I?
You're in Studio 2, Segment 2. Shirley, it's me, Avi Wolfman Aaron, your co-host.
What's wrong? I'm traumatized. I have no idea how that happened or why. And that does seem to describe a lot of customer service experiences. But is customer service getting worse? Could technology come to the rescue? To help us answer those questions, we have Wall Street Journal reporter Katie Dayton. She covers customer experience, user experience, and product design. Katie, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
And folks, our phone lines are open, and they are staffed by actual people.
Thank goodness.
We would love to hear your customer service stories, bad and good, or maybe you just want someone to explain why the chatbot is so annoying. Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org.
And Katie, I mean, I think you could sense it just in that little segment earlier. But overall, I think consumers are feeling like this sense of helplessness when it comes to customer services or customer service in general. Why have companies positioned this aspect of operating their businesses so far down the priority list?
Well, I think the easy answer to that is because they can get away with it. Mm-hmm. A lot of companies don't compete on customer service, right? It's still very much in most industries, you know, competing on price, competing on product. It's very difficult for them to raise the bar collectively when those that do raise it, you know, they're not often the ones that are winning out. And if they are winning out, it's not usually because of their customer experience, right? So there's kind of very little incentive, especially for American companies, you know, and in the States, there's no big overriding government agency that can be looking at this and, you know, penalizing them for bad customer service. Obviously, stuff that's illegal and stuff that's doing some dodgy things with your data can be. But just being irritating and difficult to work to work with, it's very hard for them to. It was very easy for them to get away with it, basically.
Well, it's like
it's not illegal to be bad, basically.
Right. We're an afterthought. We feel like an afterthought because we are an afterthought.
And you just said something really interesting there, Katie, about how there's no incentive to compete on customer service. And I want to bring in an email from Leah because I think maybe there's some nuance to that in terms of what type of sector you're competing in. And here's this email from our listener, Leah. Amazon has the best customer service I have ever experienced, according to Leah. Meanwhile, my health insurance is the worst. So cool, I can buy mostly useless stuff and get a refund if need be. Meanwhile, my health will likely deteriorate. And that's a little tongue-in-cheek, but I think it captures a lot of people's frustration. Health insurance, I guess, is a more captive market, I would think, whereas Amazon, they're more just out there competing, I guess. Does it matter what type of industry you're in, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, exactly, with health insurance. I mean, for me personally, I'm stuck with one, and therefore my customer experience can be bad with them. Same with airlines, right? You know, they do try. I mean, they're always competing for the best airline in the country. But, you know, if you're living in a city where that's staffed by like one airline, that competitive element goes away, right? You're kind of stuck, and even if you complained every day of your life, it's probably not going to change anything. Now with Amazon, Amazon's a really interesting example of a very successful company that competes on price as well and does offer a customer experience. And I personally only kind of was on the end of that a few months ago. For the first time ever, I had to complain about something to them, and I was blown away. It does have very good customer experience. You use a chatbot, but you do feel like you are speaking to a human on the other end. If you did want to call, you could. But it also made me realize, in all my years of being a customer with them, I've never had to complain. And I think this is an interesting point. It's customer experience is one of those things where, unless you are personally very touched by good customer experience, it's the bad stuff that you remember. Mm-hmm. If you're served perfectly well, it's very unlikely that you're going to really be thinking about that company, you know, super positively. It's kind of a given. You kind of think, well, this is the way I should be treated at all times. It's when it's bad, that's when you remember, and it kind of instills this animalistic irritation in us when we feel like we're being overlooked as a paying customer.
Yeah, there's so much rage.
So much rage.
Now, Katie, you know, we've been accustomed and kind of gotten used to these overseas call centers. Like, you know, you're talking to people about your problems. But have companies, or are they now turning more to AI and like using the chatbot model?
They really are. When ChatGPT, the beginning of last year, was, you know, the next hot thing, I spoke to a lot of companies that, you know, that provide outsourced call centers, and, you know, they're called kind of customer experience as a service companies. And they were all incredibly excited by this idea. You know, we finally have chatbot technology that can understand people a lot better. It can understand nuance. It can understand, you know, dialects, accents, that kind of thing. They are investing very heavily in it. The question will be whether that shakes out to work, because as we know now, a lot of companies already invested in chatbots, and I think we've all had that experience of them not being able to understand a very basic request. So AI, yes, it's, you know, it's definitely a way for them to save money. They don't have to even pay outsourced labor, even if that labor was incredibly cheap. But of course, you know, we know that people do, in competitive industries, they do tend to leave. I think, you know, cell phone providers is a really good one. And some companies in that sector have started to lean in on the fact that their call centers are in the US or in the country that you're calling from, as a point of differentiation, which is very interesting.
I'm going to read a comment here from Craig in New Jersey who says he called FedEx and was talking to robots for a long time, and he got really angry because he couldn't solve the problem. Finally, he was connected to a human being who was wonderful. And that kind of goes to a broader question, I think, Katie, about why companies seem to put like spikes in the road along the way to getting to a human. Is, at the end of the day, is that just about cost? They're hoping you'll basically give up?
They don't hope you'll give up, but they really only want to be paying enough people that can solve the tricky problems.
Right.
Mm. So what companies tell me is that, you know, things like chatbox, things like having to go through a 10-minute phone tree to try and get to the person that you want to, that's all designed so that it can catch the low-hanging fruit, which is the very basic questions. Some, you know, there's still a lot of people that still call up for stuff that you can do online. You know, I need to change my password,
right,
or,
right.
You know, I don't know how to do this, you know, and they want you, they want to divert you to do all of that yourself if they can.
They're trying to weed out the easy fixes so that
exactly.
real people don't have to spend their time on those.
Exactly. And then by the time the people that they do employ to staff the phones and help out, they're, you know, they're given the trickier questions. You know, they're not holding up the line by answering the same easy questions over and over again. So it's all in good faith a lot of the time. You know, they really do just want to make it so that when you get to the phone queue, that it's going to be quicker and you're going to have someone that's very smart and accomplished helping you out. But the problem is, it just really riles people having to go through, you know, what you called all those spikes, and it can feel like they are deliberately pushing you away. And you know, we reported even like some companies have stopped posting their phone numbers on their website, and I think that's, you know, perfect encapsulation of how much they really want us to be using online methods rather than
you really need to do some serious digging to find some of those phone numbers on the website. I want to read a comment from Dave, and he writes, I press 0000 to try to bypass the automatic menus, which I also do, or you yell agent a million times. It used to work, and he writes, and gets you to a real person, but that doesn't seem to work anymore. So have the menus gotten more sophisticated in terms of being able to ignore someone yelling agent or operator or pressing zero?
I would imagine what's happened is what happened, you know, originally, it's sort of the turn of the millennium, you had your phone lines and you had your you know, rudimentary website that could help you with some customer service things. And like, as the years have gone on, the problem a lot of companies have had is that these two things just haven't joined up and they don't speak to each other. And what's happening lately is that companies will employ one service that can do it all. So it can handle the call centers and it can handle all the online complaints and it can handle everything else. But that means that old fashioned, you know, using a dial-up phone and like literally pressing numbers, it's not working like that anymore. And I think, you know, you will have noticed that a lot of them just say, oh, just speak, just tell me what you want to do. We know this robot's going to be able to listen to your specific inquiry. You know, that can be a bit dodgy to work with sometimes as well. But you have to remember that they're no longer using literal phone lines anymore. They're using these very, very complicated technology systems that are connected by the internet.
So it's all explained by a benign technology shift. I thought they were trying to trick us, seriously. So we're talking, by the way, if you're just joining us, with Katie Dayton, Wall Street Journal reporter who covers customer experience and marketing. And, you know, like I just said, I thought they were trying to trick us. And a lot of us assume the worst when it comes to customer service. We don't give them the benefit of the doubt. Has customer service actually gotten worse, or is it just we expect more now? We expect more instant gratification than we did maybe 20 years ago.
Yeah, it's a great question. And you know, customer service is very hard to measure because it's so subjective. It's you know, people's memories are fallible, and people as you get older, you know, like what you expect changes. You know, things that annoy me now maybe didn't annoy me when I was 21 years old, right? But you know, with the studies that we do have, they, you know, it it's they're pretty damning, and so it does suggest it has gotten worse, or at least people's perceptions of it have gotten worse, and that's really all that matters. So, a study we published last year, it found that 74% of customers they had experienced a product or service problem in that past year. So 74%. Now, in 2017, that was at 56%. Incredibly, in 1976, which was when the first version of this survey was published, it was 32%.
So that is staggering.
On a percentage basis, more than doubled. And some people, like you said, is that a product of our times? We expect so much instantly now. We expect our groceries instantly. We expect our friends to message us back instantly. Do we also expect our customer service to be, if it's not perfect, is our complaint not handled immediately?
Right. Mm-hmm. And we also, Katie, sorry to interject, but we also order, we buy so much stuff sight unseen now. And I wonder if that just leads to more complaints or problems because, if I get my socks online and they're not what I expected, they don't feel comfy. Mm-hmm. Now I have to engage with customer service potentially where in the past I would have, tried those on.
Yeah, you would have had your hands on something.
Yeah, exactly. And we're also just interacting with more companies.
Right.
The amount of companies you think about that you interact just as using your computer each day. I'm not sure if this is, backed up with data, but I feel like we consume more stuff, we buy more stuff. So just by the very virtue of us having more experiences with companies, we have more bad experiences too.
Right.
But a lot of this can just be explained by this shift into digital and how things just don't work. Mm-hmm. Like the bot can't understand you on the phone and you call up and it says, sorry, try again later. And I think that is, a lot of the frustration comes with, like you said, at the very beginning, a sense of sort of hopelessness. If things aren't working at all, then what do you do? You feel like at a loss and you feel really, really let down in a way that I don't think in 1976 people would have felt as much.
Right. Yeah, I've definitely been on a call where I've talked something or been on hold for 20 minutes and then they're like, yeah, no one's available, and then they disconnect you and you are just
you're crestfallen
in disbelief. I want to read this email from Patty, and she writes, okay, there are companies that don't need to have good customer service, but if you put them on blast online, you're gonna have the TikTok army going after you, canceling their subscriptions, leaving bad Google reviews. So there are consequences.
We still have levers to pull,
yes.
I guess is what Patty is saying.
Is there evidence? Sorry, Katie, go ahead.
No, I mean, that's exactly. And I feel this was especially when Twitter was Twitter, such a big thing. The problem now is that especially like with it being X and this sort of deletion of the blue check mark for official company accounts is that, a lot of these companies have given up trying to do customer service.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think people just want to be heard, though.
Yeah.
And that's why they're going at their social outlets. They need to just let it out. And
acknowledge me.
Yeah, acknowledge me.
Yeah. It's funny because the survey I referenced is called the Customer Rage Survey. Oh. And rage in 1976, I think, had a different outlet. And people say, their expression of rage, that can be going online and writing, never work with this company again. I'm never shopping with them. That can be an expression. It's a lot easier to kind of let it out in the moment. Whereas before, if you were very unhappy, it's a case of writing a letter and mailing it in.
Right, it takes more effort.
Mm-hmm.
Real quick, before we let you go, sorry, Katie, we just want to get this one more comment in from Susan, who wonders about those endless surveys you're often asked to take after your customer service experience, kind of wondering what the deal is with that. In 30 seconds, can you give us a little insight there?
Yeah, that is sort of is also tied to this new sort of technology revolution, these companies coming in, connecting everything. And then part of that is this aftercare, you know, and it's basically monitoring the people that work for the company. Make sure, you know, they are doing their job right. They might have answered enough calls that they're expected to do through the day, but, you know, are they doing a good job? And a lot of these roles are still very incentives based and, you know, it's a hard job. And and companies also need this for data for to go to. Say this is something we've improved on.
We do have to let you go. That's Katie Dayton from the Wall Street Journal talking about customer service. Thanks so much for the time, Katie.
And coming up, thanks, Katie. Coming up, we talk with famed author Amy Tan about birding.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Shirley Min, in for Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. You likely know Amy Tan as the author of many novels, including The Joy Luck Club, which explored the complex relationships between Chinese immigrant mothers and their American-born daughters. Her new book explores very different relationships, those between the birds in her backyard and her own interactions with them.
It's called The Backyard Bird Chronicles and includes her incredible color drawings of the birds she observed out of her window every day. But Tan wasn't always an avid birder or an artist. Last week, she sat down with Cherry Gregg to talk about how she fell in love with birds.
I read in your book that you always loved nature from the time you were a little teeny child, but you sort of missed birds. How did that happen?
I think part of it was I was nearsighted and didn't wear my glasses all the time. And that also I played in the creek, and you're a little kid. You're looking at the sidewalk. You're looking at caterpillars and snakes and spiders and lizards. And that was what I was more interested in. Mm-hmm. I caught snakes, you know, and lizards, but I didn't look up at the sky. And I only remember seeing black birds that were probably crows, but they were frightening because of having seen the movie by Hitchcock, The Birds. So I thought of them only as these monsters that might kill us. So I had no real interest in seeing birds. And we almost never went anywhere when I was growing up. My parents worked 7 days a week, and there were no vacations. There were no outings to the park or the country, you know. So it's pretty limited in the wildlife that we would see.
And then fast forward, you're a huge successful writer, published so many books. And then in 2016, the world got a little wonky.
A little wonky. There was a certain segment of the population that started expressing very openly racism. It's always been there, but I think that it occurred to me maybe it just had never been expressed. It came not just in the way of epithets or go home to where you came from, but rudeness, you know, people not looking at me and serving everybody else but not me. So I started thinking, this is so ugly. This is so dehumanizing. And it has happened forever, you know, to blacks and Latinos, but it was, I think, for Asian Americans, it was a little bit more frequent than we were accustomed to.
And how did that strike you? I mean, that's a lot to walk in a world where you
hadn't
really
experienced. It made me depressed. Yeah. It was, the world had changed, and it was so ugly. The words felt violent. It made me feel that if anything happened, you know, nobody cared about me. And so I needed to go back into a place of beauty. And I had always loved nature, as I said, so I decided to do that. You know, and looking back, you know, the obvious thing is the antidote to feeling the hatred of diversity is to go to a place where there's a love of biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did.
And so your backyard, you just sort of looked up and then you started seeing birds there.
I saw three birds in the beginning, a crow, hummingbird, and what I called a blue bird or blue jay, but was actually a scrub jay. And then all those little brown birds, the little brown jobs, as, you know, bird watchers kind of refer to them, they became species of birds. They all became recognized as different birds. And that just grew. I was so fascinated that I had these beautiful creatures in my garden, and I could attract them with bird feeders. But they were just there all the time. They were resident birds. And what I loved was when I was watching them, when I looked at them, sometimes they would look up and they look directly at me. And it's, you know, this shock that mm-hmm. you see an animal looking at you. And instead of flying off, the bird would go back to what it was doing and just stay there. And it was like a relationship had started, that I was now part of their world just as they were part of mine.
Your first entry, September 16, 2017, in the book, you write about a very common childhood fantasy where you put your hand out and animals just come to you, wild animals, right?
Yeah.
And you turn this into a reality when a bird ate from your hand. Describe that experience.
Yeah. I had read that you can get these tiny little feeders to hold in your hand and train hummingbirds to come. And I thought it would take maybe a month or so to actually see that happen, if at all. But it happened so quickly. And when that hummingbird landed on my hand and started feeding, I couldn't believe it. I could see the top of its head, and I was looking at the pattern of the feathers, and it would look up at me with these intense black eyes. And after that, every day, I could get the hummingbirds to come and feed out of my hand.
And you develop these relationships with birds, and you describe them with so much joy and have opened this connection. How did your work as a writer sort of help you personify the birds? Because there's even conversations happening.
Real conversations. They learn to speak English. I have always been an observer, an obsessive person. And that's what makes me a fiction writer. But I'm very curious. I ask questions. But I now turn this toward birds. And as I was drawing these birds and what I thought they were doing, I was also trying to say to myself, do not anthropomorphize these birds. Do not give them human emotions. But I couldn't help mm-hmm. adding these little conversational, you know, boxes that include what the birds might be saying, you know, like mother bird saying to a little baby, this is your last regurgitation, you know, another little bird that's learning to eat and pecking the ground and saying, is this a seed or poop? You know, so it'd be that kind of thing.
It's little jokes throughout.
But it really was exactly what was going on, that the mother birds would do this feeding of regurgitated food and they would stop. So the babies would learn to feed their own. And it's true. The babies were, I saw them pick up poop and I saw them pick up seeds, and they needed to know which was which.
But you're looking at these birds, you're observing these birds through the lens of a storyteller.
Yes. Yeah. And in that way, I saw that all that was happening each day were little dramas. They might have been short dramas, but they were dramas. You know, when we think of survival as being a drama, that's what was going on there. Everything about a bird, what they do and how they're put together, what they're looking at, this is about survival. You know, daily survival. If that baby doesn't eat for 24 hours, it's over. If another bird is not careful and doesn't notice there's a hawk above them, it's over. So their whole being is geared to survival. And I could watch that drama every day.
Every single day. And you said you wanted to, quote, make your backyard so irresistible that they would never leave. Tell us about this backyard and how it became this setting for so many little bird dramas.
Well, I'm very lucky in that I have what would be known as a woodland setting. I have oak trees and the understory of oak trees. I also have a succulent flower garden and a succulent roof. Mm. So any bird flying over our house would see this roof beckoning to them and saying, you know, next left turn, Amy's Bistro. I did find that there are resident birds, meaning there are birds that stay year round. And I started getting the food they liked, whether it would sunflower chips, suet, nuts, walnuts, chopped walnuts, live mealworms during the nesting season. And then I had food for the migrants. And the migrants were those birds coming from Alaska or northern Canada, and they would winter in my yard. And I know they were the same ones, the adults, because I built these cages, and they were hard for the birds to get into at first. They had to learn. It might take them hours or days. When these birds came back, migrated back to my yard, they flew right in, the adults did. And the young ones that had been born that winter did not know how. So they were still trying to figure it out. And I said, aha, that's my sign, my proof that these birds have been here.
So you're like, so Amy's Bistro was like the Airbnb bed and breakfast for
it
so
was,
many
yes.
of these birds.
The oak trees, the bed. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you think birding changed you?
Birding, for one thing, made me feel so much more peaceful. It was a brain reset for me. I could leave the stresses and the obsessive parts of my mind that was on the problems of the world. I could leave that behind, and I could just be in this world that was very peaceful, very interesting. But it also made me, again, aware of this quality of survival and some morality issues, like people who feel that certain birds are higher level than others or worthy of surviving than others. So somebody might say, oh, that's just a house sparrow. You can kill it because it's an invasive species. And that felt so similar to the kind of rhetoric that I would hear about immigrants, like about Chinese people in the past. You know, they don't belong here. You can just get rid of them. So I've never had that feeling about the birds that some belonged and others did not. So I'm finding that my own views of the world are part of my views of the birds. I think that it also, the combination of drawing and observing mm-hmm. has made me, I almost hesitate to say this, makes me more smart. Mm. And my teacher, John Muir Laws, who's an incredible educator and artist, he has these studies that have shown that that at least is true with children. And I think it's a combination of using your hand and your eye and your mind to do these things. And your attention span is there for longer, mm-hmm. and it can absorb this new information and keep it there. So that's what I mean. I mean, not yeah. that I raise the IQ points, but I can use my intelligence much more flexibly in all kinds of ways.
Fascinating, because I wondered about that, because you started drawing as a little kid and you were fairly good at it, and then you picked it up in 2017, and these are some really beautiful drawings.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
But I have to say,
I did
have to learn to do that, and mm-hmm. I never really took drawing classes, except, you know, in school they say it's art time, they give you crayons or whatever, but they don't really give you instructions on how to draw things like birds. So during this period, I took a drawing class and learned things about negative space and, you know, how head shapes differ and all of this stuff, along with the uses of these parts of the anatomy of the animal. I think that you really need that understanding of the anatomy of the animal, what it relates to. I would feel the bird. This is what John Muir Laws would say. Try to feel the life force, try to feel the bird. And I took it one step further. As a fiction writer who would imagine herself as the character, I would imagine myself as the bird as I was drawing it.
And I wondered how you were able to, because birds are moving, you're you're making images, drawing images of birds from your backyard.
Yes.
They're moving around. They may fly away. How are you able to capture an image and keep it in your mind so that you can reproduce it in your
own
drawing?
Well, there are ways to keep the birds still. Suet is the best way for birds to stay in one place to eat, as opposed to a seed where they take the seed and they take off. Water bowls, they stay there a long time bathing or drinking. But also, you have to learn to sketch in 5-second spurts. Literally get the gesture of the bird and practice drawing the bird so much that you can then finish the bird later. But you do the gesture, all of that very quickly.
Fascinating. So what do you hope people take from your book?
You know, I never had an intention for people to get anything since it was private. Mm-hmm. It was for myself. But my editor was the one who said, maybe we should publish this journal. And now that it's out there and I find that people are really loving it, that makes me so happy, because what it means is they are loving the birds. And that if they love birds, they will be interested in protecting birds, saving birds. So that's my one big wish, is that people love birds and protect them.
Yeah, I'll tell you that your love for birds is very contagious. Your face lights up when you talk about them. What is your advice to someone who's new to birding and who may, you know, one day look up like you did,
yeah,
and just say, oh my goodness, there's this world all around me.
Yeah. Well, first of all, there are many kinds of birding. A friend of mine I go birding with, Chris Cooper, he said there are many ways that some people, they go out to Ecuador and they bird, or they're in the park, or they're doing it from their home. They're counting birds and making a list. And there are the birders who just watch birds. And that's what I am. I'm a watcher, but I'll go birding with birding experts. Many ways to do this. And I think people in the past have been turned off by birding because they see these people who are going around saying, there it is, there, okay, next bird, you know, it's like fast birding. And they don't know the name, so you just feel left out. They see a little flash of color, and somebody can say, oh, that's a northern cardinal, but you don't know what that is. So you don't have to know the names. You don't have to go to Ecuador. You don't have to go racing through a park. You can just sit and look out your window. And a bird comes by, you don't need to know the name. You just watch it, and maybe it comes by the next day. If you want the birds to come by your house a lot, you can get feeders. But the fastest way to get them is to put out a pan of water, really shallow pan, about 1.5 inches of water. Put a little rock in there so the bird knows how deep it is, and change it every day. It might take them a while, but when they discover it and it's reliable, clean water, they will come. Believe me, that is the fastest, easiest, cheapest, cleanest way to get birds to come.
Well, Amy Tan, it's been a true honor to speak with you today about the Backyard Bird Chronicles, written and illustrated by you, and the illustrations are beautiful. Congratulations on
this
wonderful book.
Thank you so much.
What an incredible interview. I have just been captivated this entire time.
Ear to ear smiling.
The illustrations are beautiful, and I am an avid birder myself, so I'm going to try the feeding with the hummingbird from my hand.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. I think this could be a good Mother's Day gift for you.
Oh,
if anyone that knows Shirley Mayne is listening.
Well, last year my husband gave me binoculars, like really great binoculars to stare at all the birds at our feeders.
It's a nice little sequence of gifts.
Yes.
If Shirley's husband is listening, and you should be, buddy, you know, just think about it. That was a great interview, though.
Yeah.
There is magic outside your window.
100%.
That is what I took away from
100%.
That. 100%. That's it for our show today. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez is our engineer. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager from Studio 2. At WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman.
And I'm Shirley Min. Cherry Gregg returns next week. Have a great weekend, and big shout out to all the moms out there.
Love you, moms.
Kiss me sweet, and we'll go flying high in birdland, high in the sky above. above, all because we're in love. Cha-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-